here. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, our guest says voter fraud would be really hard to pull off, especially at a scale that could swing a state election outcome. Find out why coming up. Right now, the presidential race was called for former Vice President Joe Biden over the weekend. Biden's campaign secured victories in Nevada and Pennsylvania, which put them over the 270 electoral vote threshold needed to win. President Trump's campaign has not conceded and has moved to challenge some state results in court. While Biden secured the presidency, it won't be smooth sailing once he's sworn in January. His incoming administration faces the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, which has killed more than 238,000 Americans and has left the economy in rough shape. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What was your reaction to the news on Saturday? What outcome were you hoping for? What would you like to see out of a Biden-Harris administration? Do you have hopes that Republicans and Democrats in the nation's capital could work together? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Paul Nolet is associate professor and chair in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. Paul, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, good afternoon.
Well,
it took
some days to get there, Paul. What was your reaction to President-elect Biden hitting that threshold over the weekend?
Well, I think the overall result didn't come as a huge surprise, since Joe Biden had been leading in so many of the polls leading up to Election Day. The margin being a bit closer than what we expected, especially here in Wisconsin, was in fact a surprise. It looks like, just like what happened in 2016, Trump had some support out there that wasn't being picked up in the polls. The difference, of course, this time is that Biden was able to get some narrow victories in some of the key states that Hillary Clinton had lost 4 years ago.
I want to go give a listen to the president-elect speaking at a drive-in rally this weekend. He took the time to address Trump supporters and his own supporters as he had throughout the campaign. Here's some of what he had to say.
For all those of you who voted for President Trump, I understand the disappointment tonight. I've lost a couple times myself, but now let's give each other a chance. It's time to put away the harsh rhetoric, lower the temperature, see each other again, listen to each other again. And to make progress, we have to stop treating our opponents as our enemies. They are not our enemies. They are Americans. They're Americans. The Bible tells us, to everything there is a season, a time to build, a time to reap, and a time to sow, and a time to heal. This is the time to heal in America.
Do you see that, Paul, as being very likely turning down the temperature after this election, which is still, I should say, being contested by President Trump and some of his supporters?
Yeah, it's going to be really difficult in this highly polarized era for that temperature to come down significantly. I think Joe Biden's remarks on Saturday night reflect what a lot of presidents, when they come into office, say, that they are going to reach across the aisle, that they're going to be a president for all Americans, not just the supporters of their party. But the reality is that we live in highly polarized times. Republicans and Democrats really, you know, at each other's throats, by and large, both in the public and amongst politicians. So it's going to take a lot of skill, I think, in order to try to get to compromise, especially since it looks like Republicans very well might hold on to the Senate and so have a strong voice at the table in Washington. It's going to, like I said, take a lot of skill to get to compromise and to try to heal the country and heal some of the divisions that have now been here for so many years amongst Americans.
I want to also give a listen to Vice President-elect, currently Senator Kamala Harris, would be the first woman in the White House as a president or vice president, first woman of color to be elected to the position. Here she is thanking her mother, Shamala, and women throughout history who made it possible.
She believed so deeply in an America where a moment like this is possible. And so I am thinking about her and about the generations of women, black women, Asian, white, Latina, Native American women who throughout our nation's history have paved the way for this moment tonight. Women who fought and sacrificed so much for equality and liberty and justice for all, including the black women who are often, too often, overlooked, but so often prove they are the backbone of our democracy.
Paul, can you talk some about the meaning of Kamala Harris and her election as vice president-elect?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really a historic moment, certainly. And I think it's a reflection of how much has changed even in recent years. So when you think about the two other vice presidential candidates who were women, I mean, going back to 1984, Geraldine Ferraro, and then Sarah Palin in 2008, you know, they were picked by the presidential candidate really in a long shot campaign, hoping to shake up the race. But Joe Biden picked Kamala Harris as the favorite, frankly, going into the election. And I think he expects her to really be a governing partner moving forward over the next 4+ years, perhaps. So I think it's a very important moment, certainly the moment itself of election, but then having a woman as part of the administration that high up in as vice president is really a truly historic moment in American politics.
Talking to Paul Nolet, political scientist at Marquette University, looking at this weekend's election news and what comes next. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, reactions, and questions. Let's bring on a caller. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hey, Rob. So anyways, I feel that that even though this process has taken a little bit longer with the counting or whatever, personally, for myself, it's restored my faith in our democracy and that our democracy is not irretrievably broken, which I think is fantastic. I'm also the father of 4 multiracial children, 3 daughters, and it really just I also am just super thrilled to be able to point to Kamala Harris and say, you know, like, look, like the glass ceiling of the old white man's democracy is coming down, and you know, you can be whatever you want to be in this country, and really, you know, they can see that.
Marcus, thanks a lot for calling in. To his first point, Paul, Marcus felt like the longer process actually made him feel better about the results and the accuracy of the results.
Yeah, and I think Marcus is making a good point there, because think about everything that's happened in 2020, right? Especially the pandemic and how that affected elections around the country. And you know, there was real concern about Election Day violence and other issues that could occur. But really, Election Day and the lead up to it went smoothly, by and large. There really weren't that many problems. I think election workers did a completely standout job in this really difficult environment to have this democracy run smoothly. And I think those days after the election, you know, we were all very impatient, I think, trying to get the results. I know I was clicking on the browser repeatedly to get the updated numbers and such. But at the end of the day, it worked. And I think it was democracy in display and having this record turnout, you know, the largest presidential turnout by percentage since the year 1900, I mean, well over 100 years, I think is a real testament to the continuing vitality and strength of American democracy.
Now, there are still many people, the president himself, some of his supporters, Republican senators, not acknowledging the victory. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he wants to see legal process played out, won't use the phrase president-elect yet. There are some Republican electeds and former electeds who have written or spoken out saying, yeah, this is a done deal. What do you think of the ongoing challenges here?
Yeah, I think, well, in terms of the Republicans themselves, they're really in a spot now where some elected officials are positioning themselves for the future, perhaps to take Trump's mantle from him and, you know, run for office, even president, with that idea of Trumpism behind them. And I think for many of them, they are allying again with Trump, going forward saying this isn't done. There's legal process. We need to let that process continue. And I think some other Republican elected officials, including some that are retiring or some that already had a contentious relationship with President Trump, like Mitt Romney, for instance, have been more willing to step forward and say, look, we have to recognize that Joe Biden is going to be the next president of the United States. So I think it's an interesting dynamic going on there between these different wings of the Republican Party. And I think the ones that are the most hesitant to recognize Joe Biden as president-elect are likely on that side that are most likely to see themselves as having a strong political future as Trump's, carrying on Trump's ideology, I think, moving forward. So all of that's to say that I think even though President Trump lost this election, I think many of kind of his vision of what the Republican Party should be is going to be taken up by many Republicans moving forward.
We're talking to Paul Nolet, professor of political science at Marquette University, associate professor and chair there, looking at this weekend's call that former Vice President Joe Biden is now president-elect. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Join in with your thoughts, your reactions to the results of the election. What do you want to see from the Biden-Harris administration? What do you expect to see from the Trump-Pence administration over the next, 9-10 weeks? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the 2020 presidential election outcome. With that election called for now, President-elect Joe Biden. Paul Nolet is with us, associate professor and chair in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. You can join in with your thoughts, your reactions, your questions at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see in the transition period here? What are you hoping for? What are you worried about from a Biden presidency? Call 800-642-1234. Let's go to another caller now. Donna is with us in Brookfield. Donna, hi.
Hi. Well, first of all, I want to say, like, on Saturday when the announcement came through that Biden won, I actually think that I felt the collective sigh of relief from this country. So it's a relief, and I'm so glad about that. But the other thing I want to say is that it's not just up to our politicians to heal this country. It's up to every single one of us. And if I can just kind of propose a little bumper sticker here, I think on the back of every car, we should put heal the divide, see the other side. We got to start doing that.
Donna, thanks a lot for the call. Donna saying, Paul, don't leave it up to the politicians to heal things. They're probably not going to be able to do it on their own.
Yeah, and that's the challenge, certainly, because not only do we see partisan divides in Congress amongst Democrats and Republicans being really further apart on ideology, perhaps, even going back to the time of the Civil War, but within the public itself, the public is highly divided. And it's, urban, rural, education divides, men and women, the huge gender gap in this election. There's a lot of demographic divides that are going to take some real effort to try to address. And that's all in the context of some really pressing political and policy issues moving forward. Certainly that pandemic at the top of our minds, the economy and jobs, climate change. I mean, the list goes on and on, and all of these issues are issues that divide people pretty heavily. So I think the sentiment is certainly a very good one. I think we all can try to do our part to try to understand the other side and to reach out. It is going to be a big challenge, and it is going to take both politicians and the public alike.
Before I go back to our callers, I want to get back to Republicans raising concerns about the election, and I want to bring it home here to Wisconsin. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, Republican, is calling for an investigation into how the election was run. And then today we have a press release from a Republican on the Assembly, Joe Sanfilippo, raising concerns about the election. Our state capitol reporter says there a lot of them are pretty not quite on target, but I want to quote here. If an investigation shows these actions affected the outcome of the election, we need to either declare this past election null and void and hold a new election, or require our Electoral College delegates to correct the injustice with their votes. Ending that quote from a Republican in the assembly. Paul, there's been some talk from Republicans that Republican legislatures and states should do something like this, fears from Democrats that they would. What do you think now that there's a statement from a sitting lawmaker opening the door to a legislature overturning the result of the election in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I mean, it's concerning, certainly, that you'd have sitting members of the assembly making those claims and saying that, because that really would be a real escalation, I think, in terms of a legislature taking the decision of the next president out of the hands of the people and kind of keeping it for themselves. At the end of the day, though, I mean, I think that there's going to be some rumblings, and there already are here in Wisconsin and some other states. I know those in Pennsylvania were talking about that, a few anyway. But I think at the end of the day, some of this remaining legal process and lawsuits will continue. I think by and large, they're not going to go anywhere. They're not going to really change the results outside perhaps a few hundred votes here and there. And I think at a certain point, in the not so distant future, you'll see more and more Republicans acknowledge, even if it is somewhat grudgingly, acknowledge that Joe Biden is president-elect and will be the next president. So I think some of this right now is largely rhetorical. I don't think it's really going to ultimately go anywhere in the Wisconsin Assembly or in any other of the state legislatures in the very close states in this election.
Talking to political scientist Paul Nolet from Marquette University, looking at the election results and what comes next. Let's go back to your calls now. Susie is with us in Plover. Susie, hi.
Good afternoon. Thank you for being with us, Professor. Actually, dovetailing on your last remark, I think there are some
Susie.
In general, can't hear me?
Yep, you dropped out, but now you're going. Go for it.
Oh, okay. That it is that there are states in the union whose election process were decided by judges and so forth, and did not follow constitutional directive with regard to the developing of election process. I've heard a couple of pretty venerable constitutional lawyers discuss this. Particularly, I think Pennsylvania is an example, because in the end, the Supreme Court case stepped in and said, yes, we can accept late ballots. But in fact, our Constitution itself forbids that, does not respect the developing of the election process in that manner. Now,
Susie, thanks a lot for the call. We don't have a ton of time left, but there is a lot of latitude for how states handle this, and it very often ends up for the courts to decide, Paul.
That's right. I mean, states and state legislatures do have a lot of constitutional authority over the mode of the election. And so that's been part of the Constitution since its framing. What is a much less clear statement is whether legislatures could actually overturn the results of an election once it already happened. So in other words, they have a lot of leeway in setting up how the election occurs and what it's going to look like, for instance, early voting and absentee voting and how the electors are selected and that sort of thing. It's a lot more difficult to imagine a situation in which legislatures change the results after the election has already occurred. But again, you know, if these things end up in the courts will handle them. And as we've seen with a number of the lawsuits filed by the Trump administration so far, they're being dismissed fairly quickly. So I do think that there's going to be a number of additional lawsuits. I think there are lawsuits that are continuing as we speak, but it won't be too much longer before most of these are dealt with by the courts. And I think at that point, Republicans will, by and large, accept the results of this election and perhaps try to put some pressure on President Trump to acknowledge it as well, to concede and pledge that he'll have a peaceful transition of power.
assuming that it all comes out that way. Paul, let's take a couple moments to look at the future now. President-elect Biden appointing a coronavirus task force. It seems like that's his priority, to hit the ground running on that. What could we see changing, assuming a President Biden with probably a Republican-led Senate? Still slight asterisk on that.
Yeah, and so there are still these two Georgia runoffs that potentially can determine the control of the Senate. But yeah, assuming that Republicans maintain the Senate, it's going to be difficult for Biden to get a lot of his priorities through. I think one of his big coronavirus priorities is getting some sort of, whether you call it a stimulus package or what have you, something through Congress that will assist regular Americans, small businesses, and also states and local governments, which I think has been one of the most controversial parts of a potential plan, multi-billion dollar plan coming from Congress. So that really, those details are going to have to be worked out, and it's going to take some willingness to compromise, I think, amongst both Democrats and Republicans to get that going. So I think that's going to be a real focus. The money piece of it is going to be a real focus in the coming weeks and months.
Paul, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
All right. Thank you.
Paul Nolet is associate professor and chair in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. He joined us today to talk about the results of the 2020 presidential election, called this weekend for now President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris. Coming up after the news, President Trump continues to allege that widespread voter fraud was at play in the election. We'll talk about what kind of effort that would actually take. Our guest says it would be really hard to pull off at a large scale, at a large enough scale to make a difference. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on the morning show, voters approve drug decriminalization measures in states around the country on Election Day. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at the trend and what kind of changes are in the works. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, even after President-elect Joe Biden reached a winning margin in the presidential election over the weekend, President Trump continues to claim that widespread voter fraud in multiple states is responsible for stealing the election. There's been no evidence to support that, but our next guest has been thinking about what exactly such an operation could involve. In short, it's a very tall order. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you concerned about the president's claims of fraud? Do you worry about part of the population not accepting the results of the election? What do you think of how President-elect Biden is proceeding while the Trump campaign continues to allege that there was fraud? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. John Mark Hansen is professor of political science at the University of Chicago. He was a research coordinator in 2001 for the National Commission on Federal Election Reform, and he recently wrote for the New York Times about what widespread voter fraud would actually take to accomplish. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Before we get into the issues of hypothetical fraud you look into, what are your thoughts on how this election played out logistically in kind of an unusual year for an election with this pandemic?
Well, I think it went quite well, actually. There are a number of states, including Pennsylvania, that had never really had they were not a very liberal state in terms of access to absentee ballots. And so there were a number of states that were doing it really for the first time. And other states who were doing it on a much greater scale than had been done in the past. But I would say, given the challenges, I thought things went remarkably well.
Now, you worked with the Commission on Federal Election Reform in 2001. Seems like some interesting stuff happened in the 2000 election. What kind of changes have we seen since Florida and the Bush-Gore election?
Well, we've seen enormous changes, I think, in the vote recording technology. So the real problem in Florida was the punch card system that was used in Florida, which was used as well, I think, by about 80% of the jurisdictions in the United States. And that's been basically retired. There isn't anybody who uses punch cards anymore. So we have better voting technology, I think. We have better list management, voter list management with voter registration. I think we have certainly we've had an extension of the number of states that have decided to liberalize access in the sense of having early voting or longer early voting periods. There were very few states in 2000 that did early voting, only three or four, I think, at the time. There was only one state at the time that did all mail-in, which was Oregon. And now there are a number of states that have broadened the ability to vote even past Election Day.
Now let's get into your thought experiment that you wrote, looking at how what it would take to have enough fraud in an election to swing, say, a state like Pennsylvania. Talk mm-hmm. about what kind of things would have to happen.
Well, first of all, it would be a massive effort. So I think the main takeaway is just that in order to influence an election on the scale of a presidential election, you're not talking about doing that with a few hundred votes or a few thousand votes. You're talking about at least tens of thousands if you're thinking about how you're going to change an outcome in a particular state. And if you're not sure exactly what state it is where you're going to need to make the effort, you may be talking about a number of fraudulent ballots that would number in the millions. And so there's just an awful lot of difficulties in doing anything on that scale. It would have to be organized, and it'd have to be done well in advance.
And talk about what it would mean, say, to get 60,000 people to cast two ballots each. Each of those people would be in a fair amount of legal risk, right?
Yeah, they would be in risk. It is a felony in every state to commit vote fraud. And even if you're not ultimately convicted, there's the risk of prosecution. And there's the risk of being penalized just by having to your reputation under attack. So, you know, there's some considerable risk in it. I think we could easily say that it's pretty much impossible to imagine that there would be thousands of people somewhere who would say, you know, I really care a lot about this outcome, and so I'm going to risk all of that by making sure that Joe Biden has one more vote in Wisconsin or making sure that Donald Trump has one more vote in Texas. It just doesn't make sense to think that people would do that in a spontaneous way, which is why it would need to be a well-organized conspiracy.
And how about the thought of, you know, we see videos of reporters wheeling in equipment to counting stations and then videos saying, hey, look, they're wheeling in ballots or something like that. What about the idea of stacking the deck in the counting rooms?
Well, yeah, there are a couple things about it. I guess the first thing to say is simply that in the vast majority of cases, when something seems weird, there's usually an innocent explanation for it, as in the case of the cameraman who's bringing his equipment into a particular place and people are thinking, wow, that looks suspicious. Well, it wasn't suspicious at all. He was just doing what cameramen do. So, you know, that's kind of the first point. The second point is that there are all kinds of safeguards at the vote counting stage, and they range from most states allowing partisan observers of the vote count and the vote tallies and the reporting of the vote tallies. So, you know, it's not like someone's sitting around saying, let's just give another 4,000 votes over here. There are partisan observers who can say, where did that number come from? Likewise, there's a lot of experience. So there's a lot of through the years, what one finds is that the number of votes in a particular election doesn't vary a whole lot from year to year. And the percentage breakdown in partisan terms doesn't vary very much from year to year. And so if you have people, you know, trying to tilt things on one side, it's probably going to be noticeable to somebody. There's going to be somebody in the office who's going to say, boy, that really looks weird. Are we sure? And there's going to be somebody in the state capitol who says, that seems awfully strange. Are you sure? So, you know, there's local knowledge, I think, as well. You know, the last thing I would say is, even though county clerks and county election officers are partisan elected in most cases, there is an awful lot of professional risk involved in being part of something that would try to influence the outcome by fraudulent means. Most vote fraud is not prosecuted, or most alleged vote fraud is not prosecuted, because prosecutors determine that the voter did not have intent to defraud. And it's usually people who've made a mistake of some kind. Well, if you're a county elected official, you know that it's against the law. And so you are going to be prosecuted. And if you are prosecuted, you're going to prison.
Talking to John Mark Hansen, professor of political science at the University of Chicago, talking about the difficulty of pulling off voter fraud on a scale that could tip an election. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Let's go to a caller now. Tim is with us in Rhinelander. Tim, hi.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Tim?
So I'm a Trump supporter, and I listen to a lot of news. And I think that it is absolutely appalling that beginning practically on Inauguration Day of 2016, we listened to people like Adam Schiff and CNN tell us day in and day out, without a question of a shadow of a doubt, that the Russians colluded with Donald Trump to win an election. We listened to that for 2.5 years. Without without bringing up any evidence, without any documents, without any subpoenas, without any witnesses, without any sort of evidence whatsoever, 2.5 years, the Russians colluded with Donald Trump to win an election, despite him getting 70 million votes in America, despite having Trump signs all throughout the yards across America. Now, fast forward to 2020, and on election night, Donald Trump was winning much of the states, many of the states, and by much more heartily than he was winning in 2016. We all go to bed, we wake up, and there's a different outcome. And the media has absolutely zero interest in finding out if there is actually any evidence of voter fraud to the claims.
And Tim, I gotcha. Thanks a lot. Mark, Tim says, hey, we got a double standard here. Compare and contrast.
Well, I'd say a couple of things. The first is that the allegations of Russian interference were not about fraud. They were about the ways in which the Russians tried to use disinformation to affect particular voting groups, and particularly African-American voting groups, trying to turn off African-Americans from the Democratic Party and from Hillary Clinton in particular. So I think they're a bit different in these two cases. You know, the other thing I would say is that I think that the media would be perfectly happy to investigate claims of vote fraud if the campaign would actually come forward with evidence that it has occurred.
Tim, thanks for the call. And his point about the overnight thing, this is something that we've been talking about for weeks. That was probably going to happen. Maybe we didn't know what the ultimate number was going to be, but the president had specifically attacked the idea of mail-in voting. Talked, I think, Republicans out of mail-in voting. We knew a lot of these later counted ballots, especially in states where it was illegal to count those ballots until Election Day, were going to be more in Biden's favor, right?
Yeah, this got some attention before the election, the so-called blue shift, the way in which the voting tallies tend to move in a Democratic direction as the later ballots get counted. And the main reason for that is simply that the scale of counting in urban counties is just enormously bigger than it is in rural counties. And so the rural returns tend to come in early. Those tend to be a little more Republican. And the urban tallies tend to come in later, and those tend to be more Democratic.
And one more slight difference. I don't think anybody said Donald Trump wasn't the president because of allegations of Russian interference. The election was called election night or the morning after. Democrats conceded. There was a recount here in Wisconsin.
Yeah. Right.
But right. Ultimately, it was accepted.
Yeah, that's right. And in the same way, you know, Al Gore conceded in 2000 as well. So, Hillary Clinton conceded. There wasn't that big a contestation.
Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Talking to Mark Hansen, professor of political science at the University of Chicago. Talk about what it would actually take to pull off widespread voter fraud. He says really, really hard to pull something like that off. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about voter fraud? Do you worry about claims of voter fraud going on right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with John Mark Hansen, professor of political science at the University of Chicago, about claims of voter fraud and why it would be hard to pull off actual voter fraud on a big enough scale to tip an election. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Dave is with us in Madison. Dave, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Dave?
Madison. I'm from Madison, Wisconsin, and there is a rumor going around out on the internet, and I'm just wondering if there's any validity to the thought process that there could be voter fraud via the software that the voter machines are run by, you know. There's a rumor out there that supposedly Nancy Pelosi owns the rights to the company that owns that has that, and I'm just wondering if there's any validity to that.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Worries, Mark, about voting machines or voting counting machines being hacked?
Well, there's been a lot of concern about that ever since the electronic recording machines came available right at the end of the 1990s. There has been a lot of concern about it. Ironically, the initial concern was that it would be something that could be hacked to the advantage of Republicans because the Diebold company was the major manufacturer and it had ties to the Republican Party. I haven't heard about Nancy Pelosi's family being involved in voting machines at all, but I don't know, perhaps they are. But at any rate, there have been several things that people have been concerned about, and one certainly is the possibility of hacks. The result of that has been that there has been an enormous investment in trying to secure the vote recording and the vote reporting system in the United States. You'll remember in 2016, there were some allegations that or there were some reports that there had been attempted hacks in county election offices, which seems not to have actually made any difference or affected anything. And so I think there's a fair bit of confidence. One always keeps one's fingers crossed, but there's a fair bit of confidence that that's something that is, in fact, quite genuinely difficult. The other thing I would point out is that the biggest concern back in 2000, when I was working with the Election Reform Commission, the biggest concern at that time about the electronic devices was that they didn't have an audit trail. That is, there was no paper ballot that you could go back to. Most of the electronic systems that are now used do have an audit trail. That is, it either is a physical card that you put in that is then optically read to record the votes, or it is a it has like an adding machine tape on it where you can review your choices before you actually finish voting. So, you know, even if there were things that kind of happened in the compilation that seemed a little bit funny, there are ways that those would be exposed because of the audit trail.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Let's go now to Ed in Wautoma. Ed, hi.
Hi. Yes, I think it's really incomprehensible that people who have witnessed the largest turnout in voter history think that the votes are going to be counted in an expedient amount of time.
Ed, thanks a lot for the call. Ed saying, Mark, yeah, we had a lot of votes cast, so don't worry too much that it's taking a while to count them, I guess.
That's exactly right. It does take longer to count them the more there are. And, of course, while some of the increase in voter turnout was anticipated, I heard projections for turnout of 150 million on Monday. It's still the case that if there are more than that that come in, they're going to be understaffed. And then add to that, as I indicated before, that an unusual percentage of the vote was cast outside of Election Day. The estimate for the number of votes that were either cast early or voted by mail or by absentee was about 101 million. So two-thirds of the vote this year was cast outside of Election Day. At least two-thirds of the vote was cast outside of Election Day. And oftentimes in states, you know, like the northeastern states, that didn't have a lot of experience with mail-in voting.
Thanks a lot for that call. Mark, there has been talk about, okay, if mail-in voting is here to stay in states that didn't used to know it, maybe states like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania should revisit their rules that don't allow the counting of early ballots before Election Day to help kind of speed things along. And I know other states do this. I think Florida is, correct me if I'm wrong, is one of the states. A lot of states allow those ballots to get counted earlier, and they're able to turn the results around a little faster. What do you think of that notion?
Well, I think that's probably a good idea. I assume that part of the reason that one doesn't want to count them ahead of time is that one wants to resist the pressure to release the early tallies. And that would be a bad thing if people knew, you know, 10 days before that so-and-so is ahead in this state or that state by so many votes. But as long as you can maintain security on that end, I think there's an awfully good reason for wanting to do it ahead of time. And in fact, I think that's one of the main arguments, or has been one of the main arguments for the practice of early voting, which is that it takes what would ordinarily be a really, 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 really super busy day for the election staff and helps to spread that over a period of time and just makes it more manageable.
Now, turning to some of the legal challenges out there, these are different than claims of fraud. Each state has its own legal process for reviewing votes, taking things to court. These little quibbles allows for a recount in states like Wisconsin if the margin is under 1%, which it is. Those kind of legal challenges are kind of a normal part of the system, aren't they?
They are. I would say that with this president, I think he's probably going to make more aggressive use of those legal challenges than most people would. My understanding is that former Governor Scott Walker made an observation that even though the margin of error is within the mandatory recount in Wisconsin, the actual number of votes is large enough that you're just not going to see it change in any significant way when you do a recount. It's kind of surprising to people, but you know, it's not too surprising when you think that most of the counting error is simply a random error. You know, if the margin is more than 1,000 or 1,500 votes, even on a statewide level, that's the most it's going to shift in a recount.
Let's bring on one more caller. I think we have time. Travis with us in Richland Center. Travis, hi.
Hey. I just called. I really don't think that there was really any kind of voter fraud to speak of on either side. I would consider myself a conservative that voted for Biden. And I think there is a ton of split party tickets out there, and hopefully they're going to get to seeing that and hopefully just put all this to bed rather quickly, I hope, because, you know, I tolerated the last 4 years, and I think, you know, the people that are unhappy, they just don't want to, they just want their way.
Travis, thanks a lot for the call. Mark, he says he's hopes this gets put to bed. There's still a while yet for the process and parts of the calendar where votes get put forward. When do you think this would be put to bed?
Oh, I'm expecting that it's going to be sometime in the next couple of weeks. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't really know about the election law challenges or the challenges being brought under election laws at the state level, but the people who are election lawyers tell me that those challenges probably aren't very likely to go very far.
Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
John Mark Hansen is a professor of political science at the University of Chicago. He talked with us about what widespread voter fraud would actually require and why the allegations President Trump has made since last Tuesday would have been really hard to pull off. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Wisconsin presidential elections in this millennium have been close, really close, except when Barack Obama was on the ballot. We'll find out what swings elections here in the state. The U.S. economy has taken two big hits in the last 12 years. We'll check out a new report that shows how households weathered the storm in the Milwaukee area. And are we having fun yet? Our guest is worried that the pandemic has made us forget what it means to have fun, and she's hoping we can bring it back. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. On Food Friday last week, we talked about pie and got some great advice and recipes for bakers of all levels. You can still find recipes from our guest over at WPR.org/Food Friday. And on the Ideas Network Facebook page, we asked you to share your favorite kinds of pie. Here we go. You gave us a lot of answers. Jacqueline says elderberry. I don't think I've ever had elderberry pie. I probably should. Mandy says strawberry rhubarb is my favorite, but pie crust is a challenge for me. Me too, Mandy. I actually went out and bought a pie this weekend, raspberry pie. It was really good. Sherry says blueberry is the best. Bonnie says my newer fall favorite is maple syrup walnut pie, and maybe the best is that first apple pie in the fall with Barnett's apples. Diana says just about any pie, but not chocolate. Diana says, I know it's un-American, but chocolate gives me a stomach ache. Hey, yeah, I wouldn't want you to eat chocolate, you know, just to prove anything. Sue says rhubarb custard pie. Interesting. David will go with anything other than lemon. Ellen says just cherry. Ron says any pie that my wife makes. Virginia says cranberry walnut season. Okay, I like that. Pete says French silk or blueberry. Jocelyn, banana cream or pecan. John says pecan. Also at Ezra, this is a WPR person. Only correct answer is pumpkin. Other submissions will be rejected. Keep sharing your favorite pies on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Get some recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. This is Central Time.